journey from Cuba. The transit house received refugees from the Coast Guard and funneled them to the Catholic Charities in Miami, which conducted orientation and resettlement efforts for as many as 300 new arrivals a day.
"My plan was to turn the Stock Island house into a museum," said Cruz, "but we couldn't afford the rent. We tried moving to Coconut Grove, right next to City Hall, but that fizzled. Our last shot was an old firehouse in Little Havana that the city was willing to lease for $1 a month, but the building was falling down, and we couldn't raise the money to fix it up. So all the things I collected and saved for El Museo del Hogar de Tránsito, the rafts, the photographs, the papers, it's all here."
Andy was drawn toward the hunk of styrofoam hanging from the ceiling. "Is that one of the rafts?"
"See, it washed up around Marathon. I had to get rid of many, many like it. No room to store all of them. This one I keep. It landed on the beach upside down, but there was no one on it. We hope the rafters were picked up at sea, but we will never know."
It was a chilling piece of history. Cruz was eager to share more of it, enough to fill the museum that was never built. But Andy's needs were pressing and quite specific. "I want to know about the records you kept." Cruz moved another raft out of the way and led her to the stacks of boxes at the back end of the garage. They covered the entire wall, each column 3 deep and 12 boxes high.
"This is everything," he said.
"I was hoping for a searchable CD, or at worst a floppy disk." "It's all on paper?"
"Yes. We worked the old-fashioned way. My hope was to scan these records into a computer, but that never happened."
"How is this organized?"
"Chronologically, more or less. The peak was in August, but around May we could see the first signs of a coming flood. Dozens of Cubans occupied the Belgian ambassador's residence and asked for asylum. Another group entered the German embassy. Things just kept escalating. By late June, we were getting hundreds of letters from people in Miami telling us that their father, their aunt, their cousins, whoever, left Cuba on a raft a week ago, 10 days ago. The family had no information. Did their loved ones make it to shore? Did the Coast Guard pick them up? Did they drown? Did the Gulf Stream carry them out to sea?"
"So that's what you have in these boxes, those letters?"
"That's part of it. Like I said, we heard from so many worried families. We wanted to help, but imagine the task. Thousands of people left Cuba without documents, or they lost their papers at sea. So we started doing our own interviews and getting detailed information about the rafters who came through the transit house."
"More than what the Coast Guard collected, you mean?"
"Oh, way more. The main concern of the government in those Stage 1 interviews was to verify that the refugees were actually from Cuba. You have to remember that rafts were also coming over from Haiti, which was a whole different process. Only Cubans got automatic asylum. Our job was to unite families."
"That's what I'm asking. You collected more than name, date of birth, what town they were from in Cuba."
"We got all the information we could. The day they left Cuba, where they pushed out to sea, where they landed. Everything."
"What about the names of other refugees on the raft? Did you get that information?"
"Of course. It was important to know who they traveled with, especially if any passengers were lost at sea. If the raft had a name, we wrote that down too. La Esperanza, Tio B, anything that could help link a rafter to family or friends."
Andy smelled pay dirt. "Let me be more specific. If the Coast Guard told me that a man named Octavio Alvarez landed in Key West on August 23rd, could you tell me who else was on his raft?"
Sí. He would have come through the transit house. That's where the Coast Guard sent the rafters who made it to Key West.
Can you show me which box that information would be in?"
Well, this isn't exactly the National Archives. Even with a specific date, I can only give you a general idea where to look.
Andy sized up the wall of boxes. It was no small task, but buried somewhere beneath tons of yellowed paper was the name of Octavio Alvarez's accomplice. She could feel it. Good enough, she said. Let the fun begin. Chapter 45. Not again. Jeffrey couldn't shake the thought. It reminded him of that old Bill Murray flick, Groundhog Day, except there was nothing funny about getting kidnapped over and over. He recalled staggering out of the gold rush, crossing the dark parking lot, freezing up at the press of a gun in his lower spine. The first kidnapping had left him wary of strangers, and he would never have left the gold rush with Sylvia, but it turned out that Bambi hadn't run off to join the convent after all. In fact, Bambi called to invite him and Sylvia to come party at her place. Sylvia's one of my best friends, Bambi had told him over the phone, a girl to be trusted. Some best friend. Sylvia sure had Bambi fooled. Gotta warn Bambi when I get out of this place. He tried to sit up, but he couldn't lift his head off the mattress. His brain was a fog, but his recollection of those tense moments outside the club was clear enough. Shut your mouth and keep your eyes forward, the man had told him. Unlike the first time around, however, he detected no Jamaican accent, and they didn't take Jeffrey's car. The man walked Jeffrey to another vehicle, shoved him in the trunk, and off they went. From then on, the second kidnapping was nothing like the first. This time, there was no disabling blow to the back of his head, no waking up in a dark garage on a concrete floor, no shackles or abuse. He was blindfolded for the walk from the trunk of the car to the house or apartment, he wasn't sure which. His room was windowless but air-conditioned, furnished with a comfortable bed, a chair, and a lamp atop the nightstand. It was like a small master suite. The closet was padlocked, but he was free to use the bathroom. There was a cooler filled with snacks and bottled water, and, biggest relief of all, Jeffrey still had all of his new gold caps. Those first kidnappers had beaten and tortured him from the start, kicking him in the face with steel-toed boots, yanking out his nails and gold caps with pliers, laughing at his misery. They demanded to know how much money he had and where it was hidden. This new guy was very different, and not just because it was one guy. Jeffrey wasn't sure how long he'd been held captive, but it had been hours, and his kidnapper had yet to mention money. It was as if he knew that Jeffrey had blown through his cash, that he'd spent his last dollars on those bottles of Cristal for Sylvia, that the ransom would come from somewhere other than Jeffrey. He heard footsteps on the other side of the door, then the rattle of keys. The deadbolt turned, and Jeffrey stepped back as the door opened.
On the bed, face toward the wall,
the man said from the dark hallway. Jeffrey had the sinking feeling that the furlough was about to end. He lay on his side, his back to the door as the man entered the room.
How'd you sleep, big guy?
Jeffrey hesitated, puzzled by the cordial tone.
Fine,
he said. The man pulled up the chair.
You can look at me. Sit up.
Jeffrey rolled away from the wall, let his feet drop over the edge of the mattress, and sat facing his kidnapper. The man was wearing blue jeans, an I Heart New York sweatshirt, and a rubber Halloween hood. Jeffrey was talking to Barack Obama.
I like you, Jeffrey.
Jeffrey wasn't sure how to respond.
I like you too. Michelle and I sincerely hope that we can get through this without having to fuck you up too badly. Michelle? That was a joke. The mask. Ah, I get it. Do you?
Jeffrey noted the change in tone, a bitter edge to it.
Do I what? Do you get it?
Again, the tone confused him. The right answer wasn't at all clear.
I think I do.
The man leaned forward, resting his forearms on his thighs.
You think you do.
That concerns me, Jeffrey. When someone gets kidnapped outside a strip club, and then he goes right back to the same strip club, it makes me wonder, does he ever really get it? Or is he just a hopeless fuck-up?
I'm not hopeless.
The man reached into his pocket and pulled out a pearl-handled knife with the blade still encased. He flicked it open, which made Jeffrey start. It wasn't technically a knife. He was holding a straight razor. A lump came to Jeffrey's throat.
Please, don't hurt me.
Whoa,
the man said, almost chuckling.
Hurt you? You're getting way ahead of the game.
What are you going to do with that?
The man moved his chair closer and pushed the lamp to the edge of the nightstand, making room on the glass top. He pulled a palm-sized packet of cocaine from his other pocket, neatly slid off the corner, and poured the contents onto the glass.
This is really good shit, he said,
as he cut the white pile into five lines with a razor's sharp edge.
Taste it.
Jeffrey collected a trace of powder on his fingertip and placed it on his tongue. The cool, numbing sensation almost sang to him.
That is good.
You got a bill we can roll? The man asked.
No, wait, I forgot. You pissed away all your dough, right?
It was his kidnapper's first mention of money. Jeffrey didn't answer. The man took a crisp $100 bill from his wallet, rolled it tightly, and handed it to Jeffrey.
Have at it, sport.
Jeffrey hesitated, still wondering what the man might do with that razor. His kidnapper seemed to sense the concern and put the blade away. Jeffrey leaned over the table and went at the coke like a vacuum cleaner, one line at a time, a series of glorious blasts to the pleasure center of his brain. Even the burn in his nostrils was oddly pleasant, and he savored the familiar bitter aftertaste in the back of his throat. He tilted back his head to catch the drip, then laid the rolled-up $100 bill aside and smiled at the buzz.
Wow,
was all he could say.
I told you it was good, the man said.
You got any more?
You want more?
Once I get started, it's hard for me to stop.
The man opened the nightstand drawer, removed a much larger bag of cocaine, and rested it on the glass. It was as big as his fist.
That's a lot of coke, said Jeffrey.
Yes, it is. It's all for you.
Jeffrey glanced at the bulging bag, then back at the Obama mask.
I guess I'm going to be here a long time. Is that what you're saying?
No. You're going to do all of it now.
Jeffrey chuckled nervously, but he detected no sense of humor behind the mask.
Every last line, the man said.
Till there is no more. But that's enough coke to kill an elephant.
You got that right, Dumbo.
He poured the coke from the bag, spilling a white mountain onto the tabletop.
Come on, said Jeffrey. Seriously?
What's wrong?
That's too much. too much of a good thing? A little late in the day to start humming that tune, don't you think?
Jeffrey wiped his nose nervously, sniffing back the cocaine residue.
Please, man. Really, I don't want to die.
The man flipped open the straight razor and cut the first line.
We're all gonna die, Jeffrey. Let's get this party started.
Chapter 46. Andy found her man in Key West Transit House, box number 47. Valentin Cruz had given her a general idea of where to find the records relating to Octavio Alvarez, and his definition of general was among the broadest Andy had ever encountered. She'd sifted through scores of cardboard boxes, thousands of handwritten pages, and the flickering fluorescent light in the garage was a strain on her eyes. Having lived around migrant workers in Washington's Yakima Valley, Andy spoke Spanish well enough, but reading it was a chore in the best of circumstances, and the hastily written notes of overworked transit house volunteers presented a special challenge. Hours into the task, she had her reward. The yellowed documents on the concrete floor before her were original intake sheets for Octavio Alvarez and the man she'd been looking for, Carl Betancourt. Each had identified the other as a raftmate, along with a woman and her 15-year-old daughter. Both men had reported the name of their vessel.
Se vende, said Andy, reading aloud.
Notes on Octavio's intake sheet explained that the Havana man, who'd cobbled the raft together, deemed the journey too dangerous, so he put it up for sale. The buyers kept the for sale sign and dubbed their raft the Se Vende. Not exactly the Niña Pinta or Santa Maria, but heartwarming in its own way. Andy sealed the intake sheets in an evidence bag and drove from the would-be museum to the FBI field office. Background checks were next, followed by more digging and brainstorming. At day's end, she walked into her unit chief's office to make her pitch.
I think I've identified the second perp at the MIA warehouse, she said.
A mound of paperwork stretched from one end of Littleford's desk to the other. He peered over the top of his reading glasses and simply asked,
Who?
Carl Betancourt. He goes by Ruben. He manages a restaurant in Sunny Isles called Cafe Ruben.
I've heard of it. Kind of a Russian-Cuban menu, right?
Andy seated herself in the armchair facing his desk.
Exactly. Hence the name, Ruben. A play on Russian-Cuban.
Are you saying there's a Russian connection to this heist?
I don't know yet, but definitely a Ruben connection.
Let's hear it.
She told him how Edith Baird had linked Alvarez to a boyhood friend in Cuba, and how she'd pieced things together through the transit house records. As usual, Andy was getting accustomed to his style. Littleford's initial reaction was skepticism.
Edith Baird sounds like a money grubber. Why should we believe her?
First, because it makes sense. Alvarez and Betancourt grew up together. They risked their lives to come to this country together. They got rich together. Second, Edith Baird knows him well. Betancourt lived with Edith's daughter, and he pleaded guilty to domestic violence. No jail time, but he's a convicted felon.
I'd be more impressed if the conviction was for armed robbery.
There's more, said Andy. Betancourt is married now.
Get this. His wife is the niece of Craig Perez. It took a second for Littleford to make a mental run through the limbs of the family tree.
Betancourt is related to Pinky?
By marriage.
Remind me again, what's the status on Pinky?
You authorized surveillance, but we can't find him. I'm working an undercover angle with Priscilla from Night Moves, trying to set up a meeting. But Betancourt is a safer route that potentially ropes in the entire gang.
I like it. The problem is that if you bring in Betancourt for questioning, Pinky will probably leave the country if he hasn't already.
I agree. I say we cancel the surveillance tail you approved for Pinky and shift it to Betancourt. Zero added expense. And we get a wiretap on Betancourt, two landlines, home and business, and his cell. I've already checked with his carrier. $400 activation fee plus $10 per day for access to his text, voicemail, and email. Overall minimal impact on our budget. The average person had no idea that the feds actually had to pay the carrier to surveil phone activity, and Littleford seemed appreciative of Andy's sensitivity to the administrative headaches that most agents at her level left to their supervisors. But he didn't look totally convinced.
If you add in the actual manpower expense of monitoring the surveillance, do you know what the average cost of a federal wiretap is, Andy?
I'm sure it's up there.
$57,000. That's why this office has done a grand total of 12 this year. This ain't TV, where we do one on every weekly episode.
Are you saying no?
I'd be more inclined to say yes if we had a stronger application. I'm sure our friends at the U.S. Attorney's Office would feel more confident if we had recent contact between Alvarez and his old friend, Betancourt. The rafting connection is a long time ago. Andy, playing her ace, laid a thin file on his desk.
Cell phone records, she said.
Whose?
Betancourt's.
How'd you get this?
I've never had good success getting historical information out of cell phone carriers without a warrant. Betancourt's had no problem showing me what numbers he's been dialing for the past 6 months. I highlighted every call to or from Alvarez's phone number.
Littleford thumbed through the records. Nothing after the 4th of July.
Curious, don't you think? Talk, 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 then nothing.
It's as if they reached an agreement not to make any more calls to each other before the heist. Littleford handed back the file. Follow up with the U.S. Attorney's Office.
You'll sign off on the wiretap?
Let's nail it down ASAP, he said, returning to his paperwork.
Andy jumped from her chair and started for the door.
Henning, he said, stopping her in the doorway.
Yeah.
You do realize that you just talked yourself out of that undercover assignment with this Priscilla from Night Moves, right?
I know. Betancourt is clearly the better way to go.
Littleford looked at her with some combination of pride and curiosity, as if to acknowledge that not every aspiring undercover agent would have exercised the same judgment. Good work, he said, returning to his paperwork.
Andy smiled to herself and hurried down the hall.
Chapter 47. Jeffrey could not stop walking. Around the bed, to the door, to the lamp, back to the opposite wall. He paced with intensity, as if determined to burn a path into the carpet. His heart pounded not only in his chest, but in his temples and left tricep as well. His breathing was shallow and rapid. The room seemed to be getting inexplicably smaller. Hotter, too. Don't get paranoid. Two more jaunts around the room, faster and faster. He paused just long enough to check the thermostat on the wall. 81 degrees. No, he wasn't paranoid. It was getting hotter by the minute. The march continued. His fastest leg yet. He stopped again at the thermostat and switched the fan from automatic to the continuous on position. Nothing. Obama had killed the air conditioning. Son of a bitch! He continued his walk, counting his steps from start to finish, then starting all over again. 18, 19, 1, 2, 3. Sweat was soaking through his shirt. The carpet was like hot coals beneath his feet. His face and neck tingled with fever. Cocaine fever. Skin on fire all over his body. Back, chest, arms, legs. He pulled off his shirt, stripping down to his waist, but it made no difference. He checked the thermostat one more time. 83 degrees. Shit! He said, banging his fist against the wall. Coke had never done this to him before, But that big bag on the nightstand couldn't have been more than 1/4 cocaine. Anything purer would have killed him in that quantity, for sure. Those first 5 lines on the glass had been ass-kickers. But the bag had been diluted with something. The taste of cornstarch or some other sugar was unmistakable. A common trick of dealers. But there must have been a more volatile agent in that white mountain, a chemical that was bubbling from within, boiling his blood, scorching his skin. Jeffrey ran to the bathroom. An icy cold shower would do the trick. He didn't even bother removing his pants before turning the C valve. Not a drop. He tried the H valve, turning and turning and turning as far and as hard as he could, using all his strength. It snapped off in his hand. Still, no water. He pulled back the shower curtain, ripping it from the rod, and threw himself at the sink. Nothing but a strange, vibrating noise in the pipes from the cold faucet. Nothing at all from the hot. Obama had turned off the water. Motherfucker! Jeffrey dropped to his knees and raised the toilet lid. Water! He scooped it with his bare hands and splashed his face until the bowl was empty. He flushed for more, eagerly dunking his head and hair in the cool running water, the thought never occurring that he could have simply removed the lid from the tank and avoided the dirty bowl. A noise from the hallway stopped him cold. He heard the deadbolt turn and the door open. Jeffrey climbed to his feet and stepped out of the bathroom. Mr. Obama was back. "Sit on the bed," he said. Toilet water dripped from Jeffrey's hair and face.
"I can't. Gotta keep moving."
"Sit!"
The harsh tone frightened him, and Jeffrey quickly took a seat on the edge of the mattress. Both legs kept moving, bouncing up and down uncontrollably.
"You want more coke?"
the man in the rubber mask asked.
Yeah. I mean, shit!"
he shouted, burying his wet face in his hands.
"You got me all fucked up, bro!"
His kidnapper pulled up the chair, sat back, and crossed his legs, totally relaxed.
"You're a mess," he said calmly.
Jeffrey kept vibrating.
"I can't help it."
"Yes, you can. I'm going to give you a chance, Jeffrey. Just one chance to help yourself."
The fever was gone. The toilet water had done the trick. Jeffrey was feeling cold. He folded his arms across his bare chest and started rocking back and forth.
Thank you, bro. I'll do whatever it takes."
The man pulled a photograph from his pocket and held it in front of Jeffrey's face.
"Stop rocking and tell me who this is."
Jeffrey forced himself to sit still.
"That's Marco,"
he said, and then resumed his rocking.
"I'm glad you didn't lie to me, Jeffrey. I know what you did at the airport. I know Marco Arroyo was part of the team. It's very important that you tell me the truth."
Jeffrey was rocking so fast he was short of breath.
"I'm not gonna lie to you."
"Good. Do you know what happens if you lie to me?"
Jeffrey didn't answer. He didn't even want to think about it. The man pulled another photograph from his pocket and held it so that Jeffrey could see. Jeffrey froze. No rocking, no leg motion, barely a breath of air. It was the after photograph of Marco Arroyo.
"Shit, man,"
he said as he looked away, cringing.
"I won't lie, I promise. Don't do that to me. Please don't."
He laid the photograph aside.
"Now, about that chance to help yourself. Here's how it works. We're going to make one phone call to your brother-in-law. It's a team effort. The two of us are going to remind him how much he loves you. You good with that?
Yeah. Okay. Whatever you say.
The president took a cigarette lighter from his pocket, reached for the after photograph, and lit the corner. It burned slowly at first, and then burst into flames. Jeffrey watched nervously until the man tossed it onto the floor right at Jeffrey's feet. It singed his big toe, and Jeffrey cried out in fear more than pain,
"Don't hurt me! Please don't!"
The fire burned itself out, the remnants of the photograph only slightly more charred than the actual man who was in it.
"Nothing to worry about," he told Jeffrey, "as long as your brother-in-law shows us the love."
Chapter 48. Reuben spent Friday's happy hour at the BMW car dealership. He'd picked up his old Malibu from the paint and body shop around noon. The thinking was that a color change would make it safe to drive again, just in case someone had seen him with Octavio before the hit and run. It looked awesome in metallic blue, and Reuben decided it was at peak trade-in value, irresistible to any self-respecting gangbanger who had the cash to dress it up with chrome rims and low-rider suspension. The time had come to dump it.
"We have very attractive financing available," the salesman said. It was just the two of them in the tiny sales office. A glass wall separated them from the cavernous showroom. Behind them, beneath the LED lights, an assortment of new German vehicles glistened.
"I'll pay cash," said Reuben. "Less $5,000 for my trade-in."
"Which vehicle are you interested in?"
"The 6 Series convertible in black."
"Let's see what I have on the lot," the salesman said, checking his computer.
Reuben watched from the other side of the desk as the salesman scrolled down the list. The sticker value on many of these cars approached 6 figures, but that was still a fraction of what he'd taken in the heist. Hiding the money had been the smart plan, but not if Reuben was the only one doing it. He was fed up with Jeffrey and Pinky. He knew Edith Baird was a con artist who would scam him in a minute. Octavio's girlfriend had all the markings of a greedy bitch. Reuben wasn't sure how he was going to convince Savannah that he hadn't used Jeffrey's money to buy an $80,000 car. But he'd worry about that later. It was time he spent some damn money before everyone else burned through it.
"We have 2 in black," said the salesman.
"One's the sport package."
"That's the one I want."
"Excellent choice. Our mechanic will need your car keys to evaluate the trade-in. Meanwhile, let me check with my manager and see if I can get the very best price for you."
Reuben handed over the keys and tried not to burst out laughing as the salesman left the office. "The very best price for you." The airport heist paled in comparison to the car dealer dance of duplicity. Talk about lying thieves. His cell rang and Jeffrey's number popped up. Reuben let it go to voicemail, but another ring followed immediately, the same number. This time Reuben answered. It wasn't Jeffrey.
"I have your brother-in-law."
"The fat one," the caller said. No Jamaican accent, it wasn't Ramsey.
"Who is this?"
"Your wake-up call. I know what you guys did. And I don't want to get involved with the feds or anything like that. That's not my problem. The only thing I want is my money."
"Your money?"
"Yeah. It's mine now.
$500,000 should do it."
Reuben checked his anger, then reached behind and closed the office door.
"Listen to me, asshole. I don't know who you are, and I don't care. I'm not paying a dime to you or anyone else."
"You need a better attitude, or your brother-in-law is going to feel a lot of pain."
Reuben wasn't buying it. He'd put Ramsey in his place earlier, and this call smelled no less like a scam. He wasn't sure who this new voice was, the guy playing the role of kidnapper, but Reuben couldn't resist calling his bluff.
"Pain is temporary," said Reuben.
"What?"
"You heard me.
Pain schmain.
Jeffrey will get over it."
"This is your brother-in-law we're talking about."
"I understand.
But I have nothing to do with what Jeffrey's done with his life."
"Do what you gotta do, pal."
There was silence on the line, as if the caller couldn't quite comprehend.
"Hold on. I want you to tell that to Jeffrey."
Reuben was tempted to hang up, but he wanted his brother-in-law to know that he was onto his game. Jeffrey came on the line, his voice racing.
"Bro, you gotta fix this."
"What do you want me to do?"
"Pay him. Where's your money?"
"I spent it all."
"No!"
"Strippers, cocaine, diamonds on my timepiece, tigers on a gold leash, it's all gone."
"Don't do this. Does the money mean more to you than me, than my life?"
"Hey, you looked for it, bro. Now you deal with it. I told you to get the fuck out of Miami, but you wanted a party. Now deal with it."
"I can't believe you're saying this."
Reuben glanced over his shoulder through the glass wall. No sign of the salesman in the showroom, but he was sure to return soon. It was time to put this nonsense to bed.
"Jeffrey, I'm done playing these games. You're on your own."
"Please, please don't say that. This guy is a killer, bro. He showed me Marco's picture."
Reuben hesitated. The mention of Marco made it seem less like a game, but Reuben stuck to his guns.
"I don't believe you. You sound all coked up to me."
"Yes, I am. He made me do a mountain of coke."
"Made you?"
Reuben said, scoffing.
"Yeah.
Kidnappers are generous that way, always sharing their coke. What kind of idiot do you think I am, Jeffrey?
This is real, bro. If you don't pay, he's going to light me up like a Roman candle, just like he did with Marco."
"Stop it, Jeffrey," he said bitterly.
"I'm done playing this game. Ramsey called me this morning and fed me the same bullshit."
"Huh?"
"It was pathetic,"
said Reuben, turning on his Jamaican accent, mimicking Ramsey.
"Jeffrey rang me on my cell, man. He's crying, he's scared, his voice is shaking. He says he's been kidnapped again and needs his guardian angel to help him."
"I never called Ramsey."
"Don't lie to me.
What'd you do, cook this up at the Gold Rush over a gram of coke and $1,000 bottle of champagne?"
"Hey, here's the plan, man,"
he said, turning on the accent again.
"Let's call Reuben and tell him his brother-in-law be kidnapped, get a $500,000 out of him."
"No, no! I never called Ramsey about being kidnapped. This is not a con, bro."
"Who'd you get to play the kidnapper? One of Ramsey's buddies?"
"I don't know who he is, but he burned Marco to a crisp. This is not a joke. He is going to torch me."
"Well, that's too fucking bad, Jeffrey. You can burn now. You can burn in hell. I don't care anymore. Don't call me again."
Reuben hung up, so full of anger that he was out of breath. He realized that to an outsider, his words would have sounded cold as ice, but it was the only way to deal with a desperate drug addict who was out of money. This kidnapping wasn't real. Jeffrey was working with Ramsey. No one was going to burn Jeffrey, no way.
"Unless it's not a scam."
There was that possibility.
Reuben reached for his cell, ready to dial Ramsey's number, then stopped. If he was going to cut through the smoke, a phone call wouldn't do it. Better to have a face-to-face with Ramsey and catch him unawares. An ambush. The door opened. "Good news," the salesman said as he breezed into the office. "I can let you drive away in a beautiful black 6 Series convertible with a sports package for $83,000.
"That's $3,000 over sticker."
"I know, isn't that great? My manager has never done this on a back-ordered vehicle. A small premium puts you ahead of everyone on the waiting list."
Reuben rose. "Give me my car keys."
"Whoa! Where are you going, my friend?"
"Out of here."
"I see you drive a hard bargain. Maybe I can get my manager to see his way to 82.5.
"I want my keys."
"Let's sit down and discuss my keys now."
The salesman patted down his pants pockets as if searching.
"Damn, I must have left them with the mechanic. Unfortunately, he just went on break and won't be back till—" Reuben grabbed him by the collar and got right in his face.
"Give me my fucking car keys or I will snap your skinny neck."
Slowly, the salesman pulled the keys from his coat pocket. Reuben snatched them away and gave the salesman a little shove on his way out of the office, then hurried across the glitzy showroom and into the parking lot. The tired old game. Keys, keys, who's got the car keys? Had pissed him off. But nothing good would come from taking it out on a two-bit salesman. Save it for Ramsey. He climbed into his metallic blue Malibu and drove toward the gold rush. The bullshit was about to end. Chapter 49. Around 8 o'clock, Andy heard from the assistant U.S. attorney by phone. Friday evening wasn't the worst time for the AUSA to put an emergency request for a wiretap before a federal judge, but it was far from the best. Nonetheless, the news was good. Application granted. Andy followed up with a tech agent about the landlines and with the wireless intercept and tracking team for the cell. Agent Gustafson was her WITT contact.
"How soon do you need it?"
asked Gustafson. 12 hours ago," said Andy.
"You should have come to me then. No techie worth his salt needs a carrier's cooperation to monitor mobile devices.
No crook worth his salt uses a cell anymore if he can avoid it. We needed landlines, too."
"There are ways to listen to cell phone conversations before getting a warrant that covers the whole enchilada. That's all I'm saying."
Wireless intercepts were in the legal gray zone, but in Andy's thinking, there was a time and place to test the limits of the Fourth Amendment.
"I'll keep that in mind the next time I'm trying to stop a terrorist from blowing up a building. Right now, I'm after a robbery conviction, not a constitutional debate over the admissibility of evidence at trial."
"Got it."
By 9 p.m., the FBI had its target covered three ways. Reuben Betancourt's cell and the landlines at Cafe Reuben and the Betancourt residence. Andy briefed the monitoring team and left the real-time surveillance to the experts. She was driving home from the field office when her cell rang. It was on the line she'd established for her undercover assignment at Night Moves. The call was from Priscilla.
"Hey, girlfriend. Where are you?"
asked Priscilla. Andy's undercover role as Celia Sellers was technically over. She took Priscilla's call just to see if the seed she'd planted about Pinky had borne fruit.
"Staying home tonight," said Andy. "I think I'm coming down with a cold." "Oh, too bad. I'm at the club now. I was hoping you could come."
Andy changed lanes, moving into slower traffic on I-95 as she spoke.
"Did you follow up on what we talked about?"
"You mean Pinky?"
"Yeah. Did you talk to him about me?" "I tried, but his cell has been disconnected, and I haven't seen him at the club. The guy just seems to have vanished."
"Tell me about it." Andy stayed in role.
There must be someone at the club who's seen him. No one I talked to. That's a bummer.
There are lots of other men here at the club, Celia.
I'm sure, but I was kind of looking forward to, well, you know.
His big personality? Priscilla asked with a chuckle.
Right, personality.
What every girl wants.
Any idea how we can make this work?
Just one. I could ask his best friend, Pedro, but that's a really bad idea.
Andy wanted a last name, but it didn't seem like a question that Celia Sellers could ask.
Why would that be bad?
Pedro is one sick bastard.
A sick bastard by Priscilla's standards had to be quite a piece of work.
In what way? Asked Andy.
If I tell Pedro that you're interested in hooking up with Pinky, you can bet he'll want in on the action. I've been down that road, and I don't recommend it. The craziness is only beginning when he whips out the fire tower.
The what? You've never heard of a fire tower?
No.
Me neither, said Priscilla, until I met Pedro. It's like that old trick where you cover your finger with grain alcohol, light it on fire, and dip it in water before it burns your skin. Except with Pedro, it isn't his finger, and he doesn't dip it in water. It's also called a Greek fire, which might give you a better idea of which end is used to put out the flame.
Andy maintained her law enforcement focus. She was suddenly thinking of Marco Arroyo and the burn marks in the box truck.
So Pinky's friend likes fire?
He's a freaking pyromaniac. Pyro Pedro, we call him. I think he's a welder or something.
Death by blowtorch. Pedro sounds kinky.
He's beyond kinky. A night with Pedro is like having sex in the flames of hell, literally.
Andy considered it.
Strictly speaking, finding Marco Arroyo's killer was the job of Detective Watts and the homicide unit at MDPD, but it could also be the road to cracking the heist, which was Andy's job.
I'm not going to rule out anything too quickly. I may want to meet this Pedro.
What? Are you serious?
Yeah, I am, said Andy.
She forced a cough, still playing sick.
But not tonight. Let me sleep on it.
Good idea, said Priscilla. Think hard.
You know, I have to say, when I first met you, I never would have guessed you would want any part of a guy like Pedro. You're just a box of surprises. Has anybody ever told you that?
All the time, said Andy.
Feel better, girlfriend.
Feeling better already, said Andy.
And then she said goodnight. Chapter 50. Jeffrey could feel himself crashing. The mountain of cocaine hadn't killed him, but he was starting to wish it had. He was alone in the windowless room, seated on the edge of the bed, staring at the wall. His gaze was fixed on a crack that ran from the top right corner of the door frame. It continued in a straight line for about another 3 feet before dropping straight down the wall all the way to the baseboard. He'd studied it from start to finish countless times, his gaze following the same path over and over again for almost an hour.
7.
It looked a little like a big number on the wall, but the angles were too upright. It reminded him more of the hangman game that he and Savannah used to play as kids. The paneled door was the dead stickman dangling from the gallows. If he stared at the door long enough, the body seemed to move as if swaying at the end of a rope. The movement was starting to bother him, but he couldn't look away. He cocked his head left, then right, trying to stop the motion, but that dead stickman kept moving.
Stop!
The door opened, and Jeffrey caught his breath.
Obama was back.
How we doing, fat boy?
Jeffrey wiped away the sweat from his upper lip. His kidnapper still hadn't bothered to bind his hands. The cocaine crash was enough to immobilize him.
I've been better, said Jeffrey.
Obama had a cardboard banker's box with him. The rattling told Jeffrey that it contained something made of glass. His kidnapper pulled up the chair, set the box on the floor, and removed the lid. Glass vials, a beaker, and several bottles were inside. It was like a chemistry set.
Have you ever freebased? He asked.
Jeffrey shuddered. The last thing he needed was more cocaine. The thing his body craved was more cocaine.
A few times, he said.
Those lines you did earlier had lots of junk in them. Not even close to pure.
Jeffrey wrung his hands.
Good thing, or I'd be dead.
True. But now it's time to get serious. We need to dissolve the shit away and get down to the good stuff.
He removed a small vial from the box. Jeffrey had seen it done before and knew it was just water inside. He watched as his captor spooned about a gram of cocaine into the vial. It dissolved before his eyes. The man removed another vial from the box.
You know what this is? Ammonia?
Very good. You have done this before.
Jeffrey watched the drops fall from an eyedropper, and the solution in the vial turned milky white. Then the man removed another vial from the box, which he handled with greater care than the ammonia.
You know what this is, don't you?
Jeffrey didn't answer.
Ethyl ether, the man said. Very important final step in separating out the freebase, but also very dangerous. If you don't handle it just right, it can spontaneously combust. Poof! Blows up, right in your face.
That's why I don't use it, said Jeffrey.
Then you've never done it right.
The man started to open the bottle of ether, then stopped.
You ever hear of a comedian named Richard Pryor?
No.
He was freebasing before you were born. Burned to a crisp. One of the first celebs to give the public a heads up on how dangerous it is. The interesting thing is, when it first happened, there were a couple of rumors on how it went down exactly. Rumor one, freebasing. Ether blew up on him. But then, there was rumor two.
Jeffrey watched with trepidation as the man put the ether bottle back inside the box and removed a much bigger bottle of liquor. He screwed off the cap, rose, and stood over Jeffrey. Jeffrey stared straight ahead, not moving a muscle.
Rumor two has always intrigued me, the man said. The story goes that, in a drunken stupor, Pryor soaked himself in 151 proof rum and lit himself on fire. Cocaine psychosis, not freebasing.
Jeffrey felt the cold 151 pouring all over his body. The smell of rum soaked his skin, hair, shirt, and pants until the bottle was completely empty. The man tossed it aside onto the mattress.
These were just rumors, of course, but still, I wonder which would be the more painful way to go. I've seen ethyl ether burn a guy right up. Not pretty. That's what happened to your friend Marco. The dumb son of a bitch just wouldn't tell me where his money was.
He reached for his cell, brought up the image, and held it before Jeffrey's eyes. It was the same one Jeffrey had seen earlier in the glossy print, but it was no easier to look at the second time.
Very painful, the man said. At least I assume it was painful. Truthfully, I didn't get much feedback from Marco. Unless you count all the screaming.
Jeffrey swallowed the lump in his throat.
Don't burn me, bro. Don't do that to me. I really don't want to, the man said. I'm just having trouble believing that you don't have any money left.
It's gone. I blew right through it.
There's still a part of me that thinks you're lying.
I'm not lying. I got nothing left.
The man returned to his seat, staring at Jeffrey coldly through the eye holes in that ridiculous-looking rubber mask.
Nothing, you say?
Nada. Not a cent.
He reached inside his pocket and removed a pack of matches.
No, man, said Jeffrey, his voice shaking. Don't do this.
He opened the pack.
My brother-in-law has money, said Jeffrey. Lots of it. He'll pay you.
He already said he won't.
My sister will make him.
Your sister, huh?
Yeah. Savannah won't let you hurt me. She would never let that happen. Just put the matches away, please.
So what you're saying is that I should keep you alive because your brother-in-law will pay?
Yes, exactly.
Makes sense, I guess. But I still don't believe you're out of money.
I am, I swear! I'm an idiot, a total idiot. You can ask anybody. Even my own mother will tell you. She gave birth to a complete and total fucking idiot. I spent it all on strippers and watches and all kinds of stupid shit.
If there was 10 cents of your money left, you'd tell me where it was, right?
Yes! Absolutely! But I have nothing left. I swear.
He struck the match and held the yellow-orange glow by its cardboard stem.
Please, please, don't!
Let's see if that's your story when we're done here, the man said. Then I'll believe you.
Chapter 51. The line was long outside the Gold Rush. Friday was always the busiest night of the week, and by 9 o'clock the club had reached its fire-coat maximum occupancy. Reuben stood outside the main entrance with a dozen other men who would rather wait than grease the bouncer's palm for immediate entry. The man behind him was alone, and everything from the bad haircut to the misspelled tattoo, Villian, screamed, loser. Reuben assumed he was a regular.
How long does this usually take? Asked Reuben.
20 minutes, tops. It's worth the wait.
A group of women arrived, drunk from happy hour, talking loudly and laughing way too much. Two young men at the back of the line started hitting on them, but the regular beside Reuben didn't look happy.
I hate it when chicks crash our club,
he said, grumbling. Reuben didn't say anything, but Villian wouldn't let it go.
You know what I'm saying, pal? They're everywhere. The golf course, the Dolphins games. Can't we at least have the fucking strip clubs to ourselves?
Reuben dug his hands into his pockets and shrugged, not sure how to respond.
I guess it does make it harder to get in touch with your inner pervert.
Exactly, he said in a voice loud enough for the women to overhear.
How's a guy supposed to get in touch with his inner pervert with a bunch of giggly chicks at the